In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I have a fascinating conversation with Jamie Leach, a data technologist and the CEO and founder of Open Data Australia. She has an extensive background in project management, finance, technology, and defense, as well as leading data and technology companies through capital raising and global expansion. A reminder that, like all other recent episodes, this one was recorded before the global pandemic, but I think it's a really fantastic and really relevant conversation at this time. So in this episode, Jamie and I discuss her passion for the transformative potential of data if it is leveraged and harnessed in a positive way. We talk about what sparked her interest in data and the smart community space, and how making good use of data can help future-proof businesses and organizations going forwards. We cover so much, including the challenges and opportunities of using and analyzing data well, particularly for governments, and the different skill sets that are needed. Jamie tells us why it's so important that we are educated and empowered about data, especially for those who don't have data literacy already, and the importance of just taking the first steps in that direction. Jamie and I discuss how she sees Australia currently embracing the data governance space and some of the projects she's been working on. We finish our chat exploring the emerging trends of data visualization and AI cognitive search. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play with smart communities. The future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Jamie. How are you today?
Wonderful. Thanks for the opportunity, Zoe.
I'm so excited to have you. Let's jump straight in. And can you tell us your background and what you're passionate about?
Wow. Two very big questions. My background is a little bit unusual. I have had the pleasure of working in a number of industries across Australia and overseas. Started off in defence, moved to telecommunications, then fell into banking and finance. When I finished with banking and finance in 2015, I was blessed to be given the opportunity to run two tech companies here in Australia before transitioning fully into just being immersed in the world of data. And that leads as a perfect segue into what am I most passionate about. I think it's the transformative potential for data if it is leveraged and harnessed in a positive way.
I love that last bit, which is in a positive way, and I'm really keen to dive into that a bit deeper. But let's talk first about what really sparked your interest in this space. So I call it smart communities, but, you know, data and using data positively and all those type of things. Tell us what sparked your interest in that.
You know, it's funny, I did not consider myself to be a data person or a data geek, as we quite often tongue-in-cheek tend to call each other, for most of my adult life. But when I look back on it, I think I've always been one of these people that loves numbers, loves spatial, and I think data has always been that point of truth, if you like, that central component across all of my different roles and responsibilities. To me, data is evidence. But what a lot of people underestimate or miss the opportunity to do is really truly dive in and understand that data and then see what the potential of that data will be going forward.
And what is a smart community to you?
Wow, that is a very difficult question to answer, and one that I have certainly been really enthused in for at least the last 3 or 4 years. To me, smart community is, I'm going to throw some cliches, it's a connected, it's a digitally enabled, it's an efficient town, city, community, if you like, that is truly utilizing current and future developments of technology to create a more livable space for people that work, transit, and live in that community. And I think it's that sheer number of different stakeholders in a space that makes it a challenging proposition to put, you know, a single succinct definition on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I've found is whenever I ask people this, we have so many different answers for it. And then what we are focusing on is really key, if that makes sense. So, you know, some people like to look at the smart community as just making things more effective, more efficient. And I think that's the smart city thing. That's where we first started, which is like making, you know, government processes more efficient, using technology and different ways of thinking and working to streamline processes, that type of thing, get out of legacy stuff.
Absolutely. This is where we get into the smart parking meters or smart streetlights or smart bins, if you like, that have been quite prevalent around a number of local government jurisdictions in Australia for a number of years.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's an important part. I think we can't really jump to the next phase until we have that baseline infrastructure or system. System is probably a better word, which means that we need underneath that system, that baseline, which is that foundational infrastructure of connectivity. But do we all need, you know, smart bins or smart streetlights? And is that what our community needs? And I think that's where the smart community thing has really come in and stepped over the top of that and added a different layer, which is, well, let's first look at what the pain points of the community are. And then that's what we're trying to solve. And then we can use some of these technologies, different mechanisms, collaborations, different partnerships, the human element of that connectivity to actually try and solve some of these sometimes wicked problems, sometimes quite basic problems that, you know, just need a bit of something.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Zoe. I mean, whether we think we need a smart parking meter or a smart streetlight is not the point. Anything that makes our lives that little bit more efficient potentially assists with the commercial realities of running that community or running that city, that's got to be a positive thing. However, I get a little bit nervous when you see an authority, whether it's a community organisation or a council or a government, that seems to set up a committee or task an element, a faction to create a smart city / smart community, when they immediately go for some of these what we could call lower hanging fruit. In a way, I worry they're missing the underlying part that you touched upon earlier. It's this connectivity, it's the infrastructure, the baseline that will enable all initiatives and all pieces of technology to be layered on top if and when they need to be going forward. And I feel especially where we've got the reality is whilst a number of our authorities and governments all wish to be classed as a smart city or a smart community, they've only got limited funds to divert into the initiative. And if you're spending them all on these low-hanging fruits, you're really not setting yourself up for that longer-term future success of making that jump from a standard community to a smart community, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. I think there's, I mean, a lot of, when we talk from local government perspective, there's different, I guess, processes or what's the word, approaches that governments have taken. And some have kind of, the early adopters have kind of picked up those, let's test and try this out. But actually, if you talk to the more mature in their thinking kind of ones, then it is about testing and trialing these things so then it can actually spread scale or whatever, that type of thing. But they've actually first addressed that connectivity piece, which is really, really important. Because in our communities, it's all well and good. It's a lot. I talk about this a lot with mobility, looking at mobility around the world. It was my intention was not to necessarily just look at the fancy new technology, but actually what does the current network look like now? What are the pain points that people are experiencing and what are we thinking about the future? Because it's all well and good if you have an autonomous car that's a single occupancy vehicle that, you know, only wealthy people can afford to cruise around in. But if you don't have, if you're not using smart to address poverty and the people with the most at stake, if we don't get this right, then it's, I don't think we can call it smart.
I agree totally. And I think this is where the data doesn't lie. And if we pair things back, even pre the technology, and we come back to how are you collecting that data, even of, as you said, the existing systems, the existing needs, before you start to try to forecast future needs and future uses or inclusions of technology? I see, sadly, that there's still a number, you know, a percentage, a number, I won't name anybody specifically, that struggles with that most efficient collection of data, let alone any sort of analysis, visualization, be it spatial or traditional, going forward. And this sort of brings me back to one of my true passions of trying to help organizations, being public or private, to literally say, am I making the greatest use of my data before I can even future-proof my business going forward?
Yeah, absolutely. I think people sometimes forget that we have so much data right now. And so we actually need to be using, protecting, collecting that data we have now in the most efficient way. And, you know, we obviously continue to collect data every, as we're talking, every second of the day as well. And can we actually look at, well, rather than have some high-tech thing in something, you know, some area that only one department looks at or whatever, how do we spread that across the whole, if we're talking local government, for example, whole, you know, departments to actually start working better together? Like, that's, for me, one of the biggest things that we need to work on from a, just from a systems perspective, is actually being able to work better together, because the next generation of the workforce won't allow the inefficiencies to, like, they won't want to work in places where the inefficiencies are so great, people can see them, but they just don't want to do anything about them.
Yeah, I've got an 18-year-old daughter. I know that makes me really old, who has recently joined the workforce, and she's forever coming home and saying to me, oh my gosh, Mum, they're still doing things this way, or they do things that way. And I have to keep reminding her that I fundamentally believe people do the best they can with the knowledge and the tools they have on hand at any one time. And governments are certainly no different. We look to government as almost being that pillar of the correct way or the best way of doing things. We certainly hope that's the way it is. But some of these governments, be it local, state or federal departments, they are so large and they have so many responsibilities that it would be naive to think that in some cases they are utilising the data to the best methods. I know in the Open Data Institute in London, they started running a course last year on trying to get more everyday business insights out of business data. And government departments were one of the biggest subscribers to it, because they could truly see that their staff did not feel equipped or empowered to make these even little changes for massive outcomes.
And that's so true what you just hit on there, which is the empowered bit, because I think particularly, you know, the hierarchy, it is very difficult for even someone isn't a data analyst. And also we've got to realise that skill sets are different. The skill set to actually get insight out of data is very different to an engineer or an administration person or a, you know, somebody that inputs data or something like that. We need to remember, we need to be hiring for those different skill sets, which obviously we are, but I think particularly when resources are low and in regional areas where we only have a certain amount of people working in, say, local government or even business, small businesses, those skill sets aren't there. And I think we can learn and build those and we can use tools, but it's that empoweredness or empowered.
Yeah, absolutely right there. I ran a series of training along with some of my colleagues last year on a number of government departments. We did open data in a day. Now, it sounded quite, you know, low-level flippant, but we had over 100 government staff come through over 4 different cohorts. And in the course of a day, we literally took them through what was open data, why it exists, where the potential, how easy it is, no matter what your job is, from the lowest levels up to the CIO levels, to raise the quality of that data. How do you start to recognize those opportunities? How do you start to build out a business case so that you can actually get that internal support should you see a better process or a better way to improve what you're doing with the data? And finally, that empowerment piece where they could manage up and down. Now, I found it really exciting to just see that confidence shift in the course of a single day of just sitting in front of a computer lab, where it really did remind me that, that quite often some people, irrespective of government or banking or law or anything, we're talking about individuals that can have a career potential for 30, 40 years. How fast or how much has the world changed in that time? And a lot of time formal education happens at the start, and then you're expected to just keep abreast of changes as technology is introduced and it continues to change on an annual basis. It's no wonder that sometimes people don't feel their skill set has kept up with the role that they're now sitting in. And they're scared in a lot of cases to put their hand up and say, I'm not as confident as I could be. I don't want to seem like I can't do my job, but I'd love to find somewhere that I can actually get some help. And that help does exist. And it didn't matter what department was in front of me. It was across the board, which was another interesting observation.
Mm. Coming back to the individual, I think that's so important because it's, yeah, that's the thing. It's not just about government and the way they do it, industry and the way they do it, consulting and the way they do it, small business, education, you know, academia, whatever, because it's across the board that these mm-hmm. changes are affecting, one, our individual lives, but two, the businesses and the places where we work and live and play. So it is, yeah, it's a fascinating time. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of people, obviously, on the podcast and talking to IT professionals in specifically, I asked them, is this just one of those things that because we're in it, like me being under 30, is it, I just think that everything is changing really quickly because, you know, I haven't experienced anything before, if that makes sense. But they said, well, no, actually, this time, the technology and the change is just rapidly increasing, even in the very technical IT space, where one day you can be competent and the next you can be learning again because Absolutely. You're just not up to date.
Which, and then you couple that with changing landscape in an ecosystem where if an organization was going to actually keep up to date with the latest technology, they'd be changing out their entire platforms, middleware, pieces of equipment almost on an annual basis. That is just inconceivable. But if you're looking at the skills of the individual that's doing some of the most important processing or administrative work, they have to be ready to adopt and keep on top of every one of those changes. But the systems rarely change. The actual governance of the data changes even less. And if we look at that strategic transformation in the governance space, I have been asked to speak to a number of very large organisations and departments lately about that, where they are finally realising that they are potentially long, we're talking decades overdue for a strategic transformation, but they almost feel overwhelmed by it now, where it's going to touch upon everything from vendors to scalability to continuity, right through to traditional governance. And any sort of review or transformation is going to have to touch upon every one of those points and at least 20 other points. So now the next big question is, we know we need to do it. Can we do it? Do we need to go external? Do we need to go to a consultancy firm? Oh my gosh, what is this going to cost? It's all just too hard, so we're going to do nothing. And that's what I'm seeing time and time again. Even when they realise they have to, they're still scared to take that step.
What are some of the biggest dangers in not reviewing and updating that data governance structure?
Oh, without a doubt, you start to leave yourself open to all sorts of privacy concerns. You start to leave yourself open to cybersecurity and security breaches. You leave yourself open to potentially, to me, the two most crippling things an organization can do are redundancies, where really much needed operations or exercises are just slipping through the cracks because nobody's owning them, or worse, duplications. As you see through a large organisation where you'll have a number of teams or departments all starting to do the same thing, you start to have isolated procurement of technology, duplication of processes. Every one of those files is being stored in a different location with a different naming convention. It doesn't take much to start to realise that you are building a stack of cards that could easily be brought down very simply and no genuine way of building it back up again.
Mm, yeah, I think that's so, I don't know what the word is, but it's key to talk about those things, I suppose, because I think people think that not making a decision now is actually making a decision not to act on these things, and that's where the danger is. So there's actually no choice anymore to not keep up with this rapid change, which sounds really scary and overwhelming. But actually, I think we need to think about this in an incremental manner, and taking that first step to say, yes, we need to do something different is actually one of the hardest ones. And yes, you have to get some consultants and this and that or whatever, but I think we're seeing more and more, if we aren't doing that, those breaches of privacy, which I think will increase exponentially this year and beyond. And I'm just making that up. So tell me
I 110% agree with that. I had the privilege of chairing a data privacy and protections conference in Sydney last year and had a number of the biggest brands in Australia all speaking at it, and they all agree, and this was from their chief risk officer, general counsel perspective, they all agree it's not a case of if they are going to be breached, it's when. Mm-hmm. And that same goes for government. You know, some of the smallest brands that you would not think anybody would target are just as much of a focus.
Mm. And is it because, you know, and I guess it depends on what it is, but if you can get into one smaller brand, it may have connections to other ones and that type of thing, or is it making those kind of aggregating that data with other things? And
I think there's a number of motivations why people do these sorts of things. You know, for some people it's trying to get access to obviously financial data. For some it's just trying to work out, if we track your username and your password, we know statistically those sorts of sign-in details will be used on a much more sensitive data. For others, it's as simple as we're going to breach a commercial organisation's databases and start to siphon off IP. I think there's a number of reasons why people do it. And then you've obviously got your traditional, we'll hold you to ransom, or we'll, you know, blackmail you until you start to pay, or we'll publish it all on the dark web, which is a common threat.
Mm, and I think that's a big one for like local government. I mean, I'm not sure, I don't know of any happening in Australia as yet, but in the US particularly, they seem to be happening. Either we're hearing about them more and more regularly, or they are actually happening more.
Oh, no,
regularly.
They happen in Australia too.
Okay.
There's an insurance company, I won't mention its name now, that actually publishes all of the breaches. They do a report, and they actually put in that report what the threat was if it was made public. You know, we'll pay you ransom, or we'll publish it to the dark web. Companies paid the ransom. They published it to the dark web. They paid the ransom a second time. They republished it. This is usernames, credit card details, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
So no, the threat is, without, you know, getting off track, the threat is real.
Yes.
The threat affects everybody, and data governance and the ability to really look at the digital maturity of an organization is paramount to the first step in trying to protect, you know, that really, really important asset.
Mm. Okay, well, let's talk about Australia and keeping on the same track but veering a little bit in data. How do you think that Australia is currently embracing this? I mean, I normally ask about smart communities, but I'm keen to hear in your experience about, you know, data governance or any of those things that we're kind of moving along. How do you think Australia is kind of embracing this space?
Look, I honestly don't believe Australia is falling behind. I've seen pockets of excellence all around the world, and then I've seen, you know, some of the biggest organisations in the world that seem to have forgotten that fundamental process. And Australia is certainly no different. Some of our big brands have been around a long time. Their focus tends to be on more legacy software and technology now necessarily than traditional data governance. There's always work that could be done there. But I'm happy to say I am starting to see data on a lot of board discussions now, where if you go back even 2 to 3 years, I don't believe it was there. 2 to 3 years ago, you were having conversations about cloud, you were having conversations about, you know, cybersecurity was just starting to come on board. Now it feels like the momentum around the potential for data is starting to be recognized, but there seems to be this little bit of a, you know, sticking point where some people aren't sure, where do I start?
Yeah, I agree with you. And the fact that on boards now and even, you know, traditional, say, membership-based organizations, they have to be thinking about this stuff, because not only from obviously technology and data, but then also to remain relevant in the industry. So talent attraction, retention, those type of things as well, it kind of all feeds together, which is kind of what we were talking about earlier with, you know, with your daughter, you know, saying, why are we doing it like this? I think we may have said those things in the past, but I think we're now that empowered bit. Millennials and the younger generations probably feel a bit more empowered to do something about it because they know how they could influence that as well. And so, yeah, to be on governance boards, so to be talking about smart cities and technology and data, particularly, I think, that also talking about privacy and cybersecurity, like you said, is really, really key to show that maturity and that kind of increasing, I want to say increasing ubiquity, but I don't think that makes sense because anyway.
It does. The conversations seem to be there for a couple of reasons. I'll label them in three different areas. One is around the risk, and risk will always, unfortunately, tend to win out over reward. I think it's just the nature of boards and a lot of large organisations, particularly public organisations. They have to err on the side of risk. So privacy, cybersecurity, total and comprehensive systems failures, all of these sorts of things. They cannot afford to be resting on their laurels and not seen to be at least examining, discussing, putting a plan in place. The second area is around social responsibility. And I think this is where trust and transparency really are paramount. We know that the next generation, the millennials, want to work with brands that they see as being trusted, trustworthy, if you like, and transparent. And I think that's where they want to know, do the people at the top have that plan? How are we going to stay current? How are we going to keep living up to our social responsibility, irrespective of the industry that they're in? To me, I think that's an incredibly powerful motivation. And if that's what is causing them to put that at the top of the list when it comes to a board discussion, then that's fantastic. But the last one is that reward. And there are a number of organisations and government departments, if you like, that can see that potential. What if we can leverage our data? What if we can put in a more efficient system? What if we're finding a middleware system where data lineage and governance and cybersecurity can all be looked after through one piece of technology? And those technologies are starting to find their way to Australia via the GDPR, via Europe, if you like, and even America, where these threats to privacy and the ability to manage consent when it comes to data has really driven this whole new piece of technology. And they're coming into Australia. They fit perfectly into that space, and that's a really exciting thing as well.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. Something I want to move into a bit more deeply in my, you know, kind of consulting and professional space is that data and the privacy and what do we actually need to do on a regulatory level to ensure that we protect, you know, ensure that we will, I guess, keep up with the what we need to and whether that
it's kind of changing because the regulations keep changing, the expectation keeps changing, and the threat is constantly developing. So this is one of those things that it's going to be a moving feast for the foreseeable future anyway.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about some of the projects and things that you're currently working on.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I think my fractured personality is getting a workout at the moment. Still very heavily involved in the consumer data right, or the changes that are coming initially through open banking and open energy. So all sorts of things in preparation, both with the regulators as well as the stakeholders that will be involved in that world. Also heavily involved, I guess, with the startup companies that are trying to solve the real world problems and leverage the opportunities that open banking and open energy will bring, which is exciting. This starts to be some of the framework around smart communities, if you like, or smart cities. Still heavily involved in that constant battle to increase efficiency and bring in, you know, really raising the quality of data. And lastly, working with organisations and governments around those daily upskilling or realisation of the skills gap when it does come to all sorts of data on the data spectrum, not just open, but data in general.
Sounds like you wear a few hats like I do.
But that's what makes life exciting, right?
Absolutely. And I think it also helps with making those connections, because I feel like, some of the things that I talk to people on podcasts, I do consulting and speaking, those type of things, but I can be speaking at one thing and they go, oh, actually that will really help me in this field, or I can connect those two people together because they wouldn't normally meet because they're in an IT conference and an economic development conference, something like that. And yeah, it does keep it very exciting. So I love it as well.
Absolutely. I was going to say, the other thing that I have been doing a little bit more with throughout 2019 and into this year is also the Global Sustainable Development Goals.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're aware of them, but for anybody listening to the podcast, the UN's developed a whole matrix of sustainable development goals to try to continue to progress the world, not just the developing nations, but also holding the developed nations to a minimal acceptable standard, if you like. And they're everything from reducing poverty, childhood development, access to clean water. There's a number of the initiatives, but it is fascinating. The more I'm involved in this space, the more I'm getting a chance to look into Africa, South America, Asia, for instance, and really get exposed to the different initiatives, a lot of them relying on not just the activity, but also the collection of data and the evidence, and then the storytelling that data brings to really herald the success journeys. It's something that I find personally very, very empowering, if you like.
I totally agree. And I'm trying to get more people from developing nations onto the podcast as well to share their stories, because it's so important. We can learn so much from each other. Yeah.
Absolutely. That invention, you know, I'm going to mess the saying up, being, what was it? I'm going to get it wrong. Innovation is the something of necessity.
Yeah. I know the one you mean. We'll find it and I'll put it in the...
Sounds good. There's a quote I love, because when you look at the developing nations, we're talking about some of the most fundamental rights of access to water and food and healthcare and education, and yet they are finding the most innovative ways to try to progress their societies. And I think that's humbling to be a part of as well.
Yeah, I agree. And I think necessity is the mother of invention.
That's the one?
There you go. I just Googled it. Actually, I duck-duck-goed it. I think that's what that is. So, okay, cool. No, that's awesome. I want to move on because I'm really keen to hear your thoughts about emerging trends. So what are the emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough?
To me, the emerging trends I see in my world more often than not is definitely around data analytics and data visualization. Now, every large organization, every government department I cross, all seems to want to set up a team and do this. I see massive potential. If you can see the data, if you feel like you can touch it, if you can truly start to understand the story that it's telling, there is massive potential and benefit to that. But, and there's a major but that I'm seeing there, if people don't truly understand, if they haven't cleansed it, if they haven't raised the quality of it or done the hard work at that governance stage, it's difficult to rely on the story that what you are actually washing at the end is true reality. So that's a bit of a caveat to be careful. AI is something that is still moving along at a massive potential. When I talk about artificial intelligence and AI, I'm getting people looking at me going, yeah, it never actually ended up being what people said it would be. And I start laughing and go, you would not realize the level of AI that has infiltrated just about every aspect of our lives now. It has become more mainstream than people will ever give credit to.
it also has a huge potential to shift through mountains of data and do things that humans could absolutely do in most cases. It's just a matter of time. So if you can do something much quicker with a machine and machine learning, I say go for it. Cognitive search. Oh my gosh, this is something I am in love with the theory behind it. The ability to ingest manuals and decades of IP and knowledge and roles and processes into a computer and then augment the internal and external stakeholder experience with a human utilizing this cognitive system or even through the introduction of a well-manufactured bot, I am a massive fan of. I've seen it work well in the States. I've seen it work well in Europe. There's a number of examples where people are trialing it here. I think it absolutely has its place, and that's not to try to replace half of a workforce, if you like. One of my favorite examples is Autodesk over in the States. They realized that the actual call center was spending so much time dealing with customer service requests, inquiries, complaints. They took a process that on average was taking 2 weeks for a complaint to be finished from start to finish. So that's not 2 weeks of somebody being on the phone, obviously. It is now down to less than 5 minutes, in some cases sub 1 minute. There is still a human answering the phone through native text or through native search or through that person typing a question into this database. They are getting the right answer first time to their fingertips to then relay back to the customer. They have not lost staff. The customers are ecstatic. The staff are loving it because they're back to actually doing the right service and delighting their customers, not dealing with frustrated people. It's just revolutionized their whole system. So cognitive search to me is a big one to watch out for.
Yeah. And it sounds like there's just so much potential for, you know, industry and government. You think about customer complaints.
Absolutely. Look, I'll give you another quick example. So I think of a very large bank. So I'm not going to name one. It's not bank specific. In a network where you have retail and business and commercial banking, you will have staff maybe in a regional area, maybe in a CBD branch that has been there for sometimes 30, 40 years. It's possible. That person tends to become the keeper of most process, procedure and knowledge because they're a trusted, dependable person. They go to retire. They go to go on leave. You've now got people that are around them that may have been in the job for months or even a couple of years. It is impossible for them to know everything that's within a dozen or sometimes two dozen different manuals of policy, procedure, regulation, legislation. Yet if they can actually take all of those manuals and ingest them, suddenly every staff member has the correct answer at their fingertip instantly.
Mm, yeah, really powerful stuff.
It truly has the potential, if it's leveraged in the right way, to revolutionise any customer-facing organisation.
It's really exciting. Well, it's been so great to chat with you, Jamie. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
No, it's been my pleasure. And thank you very much for the invitation.
I just have one last question, which is how can people connect with you?
Right. Well, I run an organisation called Open Data Australia. And Open Data Australia has a website, Open Data Australia, all as one word, .org. Also, I'm on LinkedIn if anybody wants to look me up, and Twitter as well. So Open Data Australia is probably the best way. And through that, you'll be able to see all of the different social media options.
Excellent. And we'll put the links in the show notes so people can click away and find you. And I really look forward to having another conversation in the future. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think we should do the next one face-to-face somewhere tropical.
Let's do it.
Sounds good. Thank you very much, Zoe.
Thanks, Jamie. Talk soon.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Are you looking for an engaging speaker, MC, or facilitator for your next big event? Then we've got you covered. Zoe is a go-to speaker, MC and conversation facilitator with a difference. She's a master at simplifying the complex and making connections you might never see. Book Zoe for your next event. Email hello@mysmart.community or head over to her speaker page, www.mysmart.community/speaking.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.